Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to the Fast Forward Radio Archives on Blog Talk Radio. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and I'm pleased to welcome you to this program, which originally aired January 28, 2008. And in this show, Stephen Gordon and Michael Darling talk about Star Trek technology and discuss how it is beginning to emerge in our world. Harkens closely to a show we did recently on Better Living Through Gadgets, where we also talked about amazing new technologies, some of which were included in Star Trek, which have become part of our everyday lives. Coming up on Wednesday on our live show, we've got a very special, very exciting show coming up. We'll be joined by Aldous Bridges and Vanessa Mimas talking about the Future of Facebook project, which they've just kicked off, a project obviously dealing with the future of Facebook. Where is Facebook in particular and social media in general taking us? Should be a fascinating discussion. Really looking forward to that. On Saturday evening, we will continue with The World Transformed 1.5, and 1 week from tonight, we'll be back with yet another archived program. I hope you'll be able to join us for all of our upcoming shows, and I hope you'll enjoy our discussion of Star Trek technology in the real world, which begins right now. Until next time, live to see it.
Live to see it. I'm Stephen Gordon, and you're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of the Speculist weblog. You can find us on the internet at speculist.com, or if you want to go straight to the blog, go to blog.speculist.com. On both the blog and this podcast, we talk about the future, emerging technologies, and opportunities that we're excited to live to see. Tonight, for the first time, I have co-hosting with me Michael Darling. Michael has been a friend of the Speculist weblog for quite a while now, and I'm eager to get his take on all the topics we're going to cover tonight. How are you doing tonight, Michael?
I'm good. I'm in a nice warm place watching the very tail end of the Green Bay football game where it's a nice cold place.
I was watching a bit of that at the beginning, and they were saying it was like the third coldest NFL game on record. Can you imagine
kickoff, and it was getting colder all during the game.
Oh man! Was it Green Bay that had no shirt sleeves on?
A lot of guys are bare armed, and I think in part it's like at that temperature you can't wear much anyway. But I think it's also the mental thing when you line up across the guy and he's half naked. It's like, what the heck is this guy?
These guys are crazy. We got to watch out for these guys. Well, yeah, I think it was Green Bay, and of course New York Giants.
It's the Giants.
And they had shirt sleeves on. So, any rate, what's the score at this point?
They're tied with 4 seconds to go in the fourth quarter, and the Giants have the ball, and they're in field goal range lining up to kick.
Okay, well,
so, I mean, it's,
if they get this field goal, it may be it, huh?
If they get this field goal and there's no flag or anything, they're going to the Super Bowl.
Well, I'm not watching, so you make sure to break in and let me know who won that. Now, of course, the Patriots won. And whoever wins this game is going to meet the Patriots in the Super Bowl.
That's right.
Okay, and
that
happens
right.
On, what, February the 4th?
It's 2 weeks from today, whenever that is.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's, let us know. Phil is traveling tonight, and he has promised to join us later in the show, if at all possible, and I hope he does, because, he's seen Cloverfield, and I want to hear in person what he thought about that movie. Michael, did you happen to see it?
I have seen Coming Attractions. I have read reviews all across the map, from the worst thing to the best thing to totally cool to totally stupid.
Well,
so now my curiosity is completely piqued.
I can kind of understand. I mean, everybody knows what the conceit is, or what the gimmick is. This is all found footage, supposedly. So it's somebody's camcorder. The entire movie is a camcorder. And, you got shaky cam the whole time. I mean, you're sitting there, and if you're one that gets, car sick or something, you're not going to feel good while watching this movie. Don't sit on the front row. You know, particularly if you're down at a bunch of popcorn, you will lose it. Sit on the back row, I guess, is the thing to do with something like this. But
The shaky cam, I think, has the potential to work both ways, because in a film where I actually want to forget there's a cameraman,
right?
You know, I Am Legend, I wanted to forget there was a cameraman, and I couldn't quite do it.
Right.
Partly because it was so visually cool to look at. It just kept reminding me that somebody's there filming Will Smith and the dog. But in a film where I don't care, it's like somebody's got to film the dang thing, and I'm not really that worried about that aspect of the fourth wall. The shaky cam can work because, you know, you could be going, no, pan left, yeah, what are you doing? Because you want to see what's there.
Well, one reviewer I read said one of the cool things was that, you know, the guy's looking at this in this direction, and he's filming something, and you don't really get to see what you really want to see, maybe. And you're like using body English to try to get him to, you know, turn in the right direction. And then he'll flip the camera around because he's running, trying to save his skin, you know. And when he turns around and goes the other way, he, you know, does a 180 jerk around, you know. But what don't you see when he does that and starts running? Is a camera crew behind?
That's exactly right.
There's no camera crew there. And so, you know, that's pretty daring film work. And how in the world they managed to do it is, you know, obviously they got their secrets on that. But I guess I'm looking forward to seeing it. I'll take my Dramamine before I go in.
Not to deviate onto film for the too long, but I just saw Deja Vu, and I realize that's like, you know, more than a year old or whatever, so most people saw it when it was in the theater, but I got two little kids, so I see stuff in the theater that little kids can see, and I see everything else late night when they're in bed on DVD later. And I had read something about Deja Vu where the guy made a comment, one of the coolest car chases that ever was on film, and when I saw it, I realized what he's referring to is a sequence where Denzel has that device on. And so you get like a split screen concept where they're really chasing the guy 4.5 days in the past, but he's driving in the present. And that was totally cool. But there were times where I was like, yeah, but they're not showing us what I really want to see. I want the camera to go somewhere else. I want that little guy with the joystick to go, hey, give me the God's eye view right now. And, you know, zoom around, which, you know,
he really couldn't do. In order to maintain the fourth wall, they couldn't do that.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
Well, I mean, I guess that's one I need to get around to seeing. I'm kind of like you. I've got four kids. I've got four kids.
I would say this too. I mean, not that the internet is the repository of all things geeky and wise, but I fully expected if there were significant temporal discontinuities in that film, which has something to do with some temporal displacements, that those would be revealed. And the ones I found, I'd quibble that. I'd say, A, they're quibbles if they're even true, and I'm not even sure they're true.
Yeah.
It's coherent, and it hangs together. It's well done. I liked it all the way across for what it is.
There's one with Sandra Bullock that's just awful because it doesn't hang together. What was the name of
that? Premonition.
Premonition. It was awful.
I just got that DVD. It's on my shelf. I was thinking about it.
You're
going to
hate it.
You're going to hate it.
As much as you like the Denzel movie, you're probably going to hate this one because it just makes no sense at all. They don't play by their own rules. They set up the rules a certain way, and then they just throw it out about halfway into the movie. And, you know, that's not cool. And then, of course, the final statement.
There's got to be a coherence.
Yeah, it has to be. Right? In these things, I mean, you know, it's silly, it's entertaining, but still, if you set rules, you better live by them. And if not, then you're going to take away from the audience's enjoyment.
That's right. And if you know, there are some things that are timeless, even in a movie about temporal distortions, and that, you know, the star actress could get naked, and that would always sort of save that part of the film. But apparently, that doesn't happen in this one either. So now my bar is low for this film.
Yeah, for Premonition. Yeah.
Yes.
No, there's nothing there that saves that movie, and it's a shame because I like that actress. I like Sandra Bullock in a lot of things.
Yep.
Anyway, I guess we should get into some actual stories tonight, and you know, we'll get back into movies here in a little while, especially if Phil calls in about the Cloverfield and everything. But what I wanted to get into a little bit last week, our big deal was, you know, the life extension story that we had, and Phil kind of, you know, after, you know, this week, he got out there and, you know, looked out on and saw that there was actually some other things that were going on that kind of connected to what we were talking about before. And he wrote a story about Methuselah yeast. And anyway, on that front, scientists at USC have produced a strain of yeast that lives 10 weeks. Now, they're saying that that lifespan they describe as being the equivalent of 800 years in human terms, and I think we can there's reason to quibble with that, probably, Michael. But
yeah, well, it's the equation. I'm sure it's like that cartoon where you have the complicated math on the upper left of the chalkboard, and then sort of a little diagram in the center that's very simple, and over to the right some more complicated math, and the diagram in the center just says, and here a miracle occurs. You're like, yeah, it's not exactly math. So the translation from, you know,
was that a Far Side cartoon? I think I saw that.
I don't think that's a Far Side cartoon. I think that was somewhere else. But I just saw it again recently, and it cracked me up again. So I'm like, you know what? That has huge relevance.
Yeah.
But to say, hey, a yeast that would ordinarily live 8 days or, I don't know, I guess 7 days now lives 70 days, it translates to a human being living 800 years. I get that it's similar magnitude, but I don't know that you can really make such a clean comparison.
Well, because, you know, people aren't yeast and yeast aren't people. The cool thing, though, I guess, is that there is some, crossover. There are genes in yeast that, believe it or not, although people and yeast are separated by, you know, I don't know, billions of years of evolution, there are genes in yeast that would translate to humans and vice versa. And so, anyway, it's cool. What they did was, to get these yeast to live so long, was they did a little genetic tinkering, and then they withheld the food. It was calorie
right.
restriction, too. And they got them to live this long. And, the cool thing is that they have found a human population in Ecuador, apparently, that possess a similar mutation. Now, unfortunately for the people that have this, it's not necessarily a great thing if you have both copies of the mutation, apparently from both parents. It doesn't work so well. It's a mutant disease of some sort. Causes all kinds of health problems. But if you only have one copy, it apparently protects people from cancer. And I'd like to know, here's my thing with it. If you only have one copy of it, and you're one of the lucky ones, and is there some really old Ecuadorian living somewhere in some remote village that we don't know about?
Like 20 generations of descendants and neighbors know about.
Yeah,
nobody else does.
Yeah, you go walking into one of these remote villages somewhere in Ecuador and saying, start talking about longevity, and you really need to meet my great 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 grandfather Joe over here in the hut. That would kind of blow the top out of this, wouldn't it? But apparently,
I think that's the concept exactly. And I also think that if someone somewhere had done it, now I am a Sasquatch disbeliever, but
yeah.
If someone somewhere was that old, I think we would already know.
Yeah,
maybe not.
Probably.
But
depends on how remote they live
as well.
Yeah,
that's right.
Exactly. It's a great concept for a novel or a science fiction show, though, right? And I would love to see that made into a movie, but I'm not holding my breath for it either.
I mean, I and we're gonna maybe get to this in a way that I'll get to reference it again, because I've been sort of stuck on this idea the last couple weeks that Tesla was a time traveler. Because the guy invented everything, and there's no way that you could have invented it in the 19th or even the early 20th century. It's impossible. That to exaggerate my awe of what he accomplished, it's easy to say, he was a time traveler, and that's how he did it. But the truth is, he could travel through a lot of parts of time. If he wasn't traveling geographically at the same time, large chunks of time would look essentially the same. So you're 600-year-old Ecuadorian, to a large part of his existence, not much would have changed.
Until the last.
You go, what do you remember? He's like, yeah, it's been like this forever.
Yeah.
He's like, yeah, okay.
People live, people die, and people are born, they grow up, they get married, they have kids, they die, and over and over and over again, and not much changes in between there, and until about the last 100 years, things started getting a little interesting, probably. But
yes, yes, and that's why I say if he was there, we already know about it, because somebody would have come back and said, "Hey,
this guy's real."
Yeah, there'd be he'd have his YouTube video,
no doubt. Well, the other time traveler is Leonardo da Vinci, right? So
that's right.
Well,
that's right.
The alternative, of course, is these guys were just incredible geniuses. But anyway.
And that they happen, I mean, there's another component there where they think of things and they get published, or they actually build the thing they thought of. I mean, in Da Vinci's case, he left a lot of drawings and documents that we can reference and go, yeah, he never built that thing, but it is what it is and it's cool. Tesla, he didn't build everything he thought of, we don't think, but he left a lot of documents that we don't really have access to. But on the other hand, if he didn't build anything or he didn't publish it, he just thought it up, he'd live and die, we'd never know.
Yeah.
And I suspect there's others of that intellectual capacity, and we just don't know about them because they didn't publish. And they don't get their YouTube video.
You know, I wonder if he and Edison had remained partners. You know, when Tesla came to the United States, he was like straight off the boat, barely knew English, you know. And he went to work for Edison for a time. And Edison, well, according to Tesla, it kind of screwed him over. And
yeah.
Tesla went out on his own and they sort of were in competition for the remainder of their lives, and Tesla died penniless, and Edison was very wealthy. At the end of that competition, it didn't really work out so well for Tesla. But as the years have gone by, we have the benefit of looking back at what Tesla accomplished, and he seems like the greater genius, doesn't he?
Well, and that's I saw the story this past week. It was sort of the definitive of current day summary of Alexander Graham Bell, and concludes that basically the idea that finally got his version of the telephone to work, he stole from somebody else, not Tesla, but borrowed that idea or boosted the idea, and then got his telephone to work. But he didn't really do it. It's like, yeah, you go look through what little documentation relative to what is supposedly Tesla created, you go look through the documentation that's available, and that guy was thinking of all manner of things.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, I was thinking about it again because this Star Trek invention list that Phil put up from the network world 10 best Star Trek inventions of, you know, that have actually come to pass, or whatever the list was.
Oh yeah.
And there's one in there where it was basically a energy weapon, not a projectile weapon, and this is based on early research and concepts from Tesla. I'm like, yeah, because the guy was a time traveler.
Yeah, he saw Star Trek for real. Hey, let's go through some of those inventions since you brought up the list.
Well, let me say this about the list first.
Okay,
they
go
put
ahead.
Some things on the list that shouldn't be there.
Well,
and
the big thing that shouldn't be there that jumped out at me is the photon torpedo coffin. That's not an invention.
Yeah.
That's a prop.
That's right. It's a marketing device. It's nothing.
Yeah.
It's a box that looked
yeah.
like it was something, but it wasn't.
It's no more high tech than one of those colored T-shirts with a Delta symbol on the side.
It's no more high tech than the actual prop they used in the movie, and that's
just plastic.
15 years old.
Yeah.
That was my complaint on a couple of the other things. That Vocera badge, which actually does start to look like the Star Trek communicator because you can wear it as a lapel pin or a little device close to your face. I saw that demonstrated, I don't know, 5 years ago.
Yeah.
And it's no different now. It's slightly more functional, and they've improved in some ways, but that thing's not new. That's at least 5 years old.
Well, the Star Trek communicator, to me, the ultimate that we have, you know, right now is just the flip phone, basically, you know.
Yeah.
That looks a whole lot like the communicators they used in the original series, so... And of course, it's a lot more handy than that chess communicator that you tap. That thing only works if you're in a Wi-Fi area. You know, if you're
you'd make it the tap also bothers me. I'm like, yeah, can't you make it voice activated? I mean, if I want to go hands off and do something, you got to give me another way to turn it on.
Yeah, It's interesting in the series, in the Next Generation series, for a time it was a tap thing, okay? But then there was other occasions where they just started talking, and it worked that way, too. Apparently the communicator was smart enough to know what to communicate.
That's right. You also get the distinct impression that there are entire segments of events or sequences of events that are being recorded by all manner of recording device. And so somebody somewhere, maybe it's that computer, is monitoring the conversation. It's like, well, can't somebody just jump in when you want to talk to them? But anyway,
I do want to list off these things, and I want us to, you know, discuss as to which one is like the best as far as the closest
to Star
Trek.
That's exactly how I did that. That's exactly how I went through the list.
With okay,
the best
all
thing on here, but I still want to complain about two other ones they included.
Well, I'll give you a chance to complain, but let me list off these things. Okay, first is the MIT's tractor beam. Okay, now this is not like tractor beam, like pulling in, you know, other spaceships or something. This is happening in the small scale, moving things around with light so that you can manipulate things under a microscope. Pretty cool, though.
Highly cool.
Yes.
And I put that very, very, very close to the top of the list for coolness of that list.
And why do you?
Because you think of light as not a way to capture anything other than, for example, absence of light, like shadow, but to actually use it as they apparently are, as what the only way I can describe it is like a magnet. You go, how the heck? It's astonishing science. And yes, they're doing it at the molecular level. They're doing it with very small things, which is cool.
But that could be, yeah, that could be more important to us than bringing in starships, though, right?
That's right. But
because you could build things with it, perhaps. You could, you know, that could be eventually. You could have a nanofactory that's works on some principle like that. Who knows? You know, we just don't know how what the end of that will be. But that's to me, that's pretty cool.
All true.
Yeah. University of Washington has come up with a medical tricorder, apparently. That's pretty cool.
I get the sense it's more of a handheld ultrasound. Cool in its way. Not a bad thing.
Well, and you just, you know, apparently you can scan people. And you know, a handheld ultrasound, you get it small enough where you could literally use it all the time. You know, a doctor could just have it with him all the time. That's important stuff there. So, yeah, that's
yep.
cool. You and I agree that photon torpedo coffin needs to be chunked. That's not...
It shouldn't even be on the list. It's
that's
not
a
even
prop.
A technological advance.
Yeah. I think they just added that so that they'd have 10.
Or they'd have something very Star Trek-y. I mean, it's totally Star Trek-y, but it's not technological.
Well, I suppose if you wanted to take your geekiness with you, you know, when you go, that's one thing you could do. I mean, but
I would say it's the low budget way to take your geekiness with you. Because if you really were going to blow the budget on it, you'd like build a mock up of the Starship Enterprise and be buried in that. Be buried on the bridge.
Yeah, I mean, or do what they do with Scotty, you know. They took his ashes into outer space, you know. So that's anyway. Yeah, there's probably better ways to do that. Okay, then there's Purdue's cloaking device. Now this was cool to me, not necessarily because it's going to change the world necessarily, but they're out there.
Yeah,
you know,
that kind of complicated manipulation of light in all dimensions simultaneously, wicked cool.
Yeah, they had tanks out there. They're making invisible. And I'd like to know just how invisible are you getting them? Is it
if you drill down into that story about the tank, the guy they quote says we're going to field an invisible tank by 2012.
That's just right.
Like that's like, I mean, that means they're basically testing it now,
right?
And working out the details.
And are we talking like a tank that's like Predator, you know, that level
yes.
of invisibility where you can. You can kind of see a little waviness, you know. Are we talking like something like that, or is it like Invisible Man invisible, where you don't see anything?
Well, this is where, and
I'd like to know how invisible
we're talking. Military types and DARPA types never talk. Because the obvious question would be, well, if it's visible and I'm looking at it from this direction, does that mean that you're 90 degrees away in perspective and it's still invisible to you? Because the background could be dramatically different.
Right. Exactly.
Right? Now, part three to that is it invisible to radar? Is it invisible in the infrared? Is it invisible in every other military imaging application so that as you look at it, you go, yeah, I can't see it, but doesn't matter. I can still shoot it because my weapon can see it.
Well, after we get the invisible tank, the next step obviously is invisible infantrymen.
That's right.
Soldiers on the ground, and pretty cool stuff. And so I'm anxious to see just how effective that is in the field. That's pretty cool. Okay, hyperdrive. Well, that's apparently there's at least one the physicist that's published something that would create the possibility of faster than light travel. That would be the coolest thing in the world if it works out. And
exactly right. I read it. I put it in somewhere in the middle of this list because I go, yeah, it's cool if it works. And if it doesn't work, it's nothing.
Yeah, and so let's. It could be the biggest thing, or it could be down there with a photon torpedo coffin. So we just don't know how that one will work out. The hypospray, and that's pretty cool because nobody likes being stuck with needles all the time, particularly those who have to have it done every day. You know, if you're diabetic,
it actually works as well as the needle stick. Aside from the non-medicinal users of needles, who I think would gravitate towards this for obvious reasons, because nobody wants to get stuck with a needle. Plus, needle leaves marks. This thing doesn't leave marks and apparently doesn't hurt. But still, there are virtually dozens, if not hundreds, of legitimate medical applications where you go, yeah, we're going to put a plastic device into a vein and then use that to give you injections because the skin will heal over it. Now we just need to puncture the same part of the skin all the time. I mean, people with ports will tell you, oh, yeah, hypospray, I'd much rather have that.
Oh, yeah. Well, apparently it's like instead of being a needle goes in one point, and, of course, they stick in, it hurts and everything. This thing would, cover about an inch of your skin or something. A square inch of your skin, perhaps, and it perforates your skin, which is like a tingling sensation. It doesn't; it's not a terrible, painful thing. And then it just shoots through the perforated skin. It shoots the medicine. Then, I imagine when they take that thing off your skin, you might be red for a few minutes or something. But that would be much preferable for people, particularly those who have to have regular injections, if that would work as well. That'd be a pretty cool thing for folks like that. So, yeah, even those of us who don't have to have daily injections, that'd be preferable.
Plus, I'm not a medical device expert, I would think that there would be sort of tangential improvements in other devices where if we could learn to manipulate the enough skin for that to be functional, maybe we're going to start to learn how to manipulate other tissue in a way that's not so invasive and not so destructive, that will also be functional in a better way.
Well, it occurs to me that, you could mass produce tattoos that way, too. you just have one tattoo of an eagle or something, and you just load it up into your hypospray thing and then, shoot the person in the arm and you're done in 30 seconds and with no talent needed.
You're right, but the suggestion is that somehow we need more people with more tattoos, and I just don't see the logic there.
That's one of those things that it's beauty in the eye of the beholder, I guess.
Unless maybe you'd have a tattoo now that you could put it on, and it is permanent for all practical purposes. If you don't do anything to it, it just stays with your skin forever, like current tattoo technology. But you could, somehow use that same spray technology, and you could change it or take it off.
Yeah, yeah.
Now I could get behind.
I wanted to give a shout-out to Matt Dewing. He is in the chat room, and he says that the first published biography of Tesla literally argued that he was from Venus. So, I would like to see that biography. Matt, if you know the title of it, I'll put it up.
It hasn't been written yet.
Yeah, well, maybe not.
It
was written in the future.
It's going to be published in about 20 years, and Tesla's going to take it back with him.
Oh, man. Anyway, good to see you, Matt. After the hyperspray, there's telepresence. Now, that's just sort of, that's sort of been a coming thing for 30 years.
I put that right above the Vocera badge because I live in Macworld.
Yeah.
Anybody who has Mac OS X has seen iChat, and if you haven't seen it, go to the Apple store nearest you and see it there. That kind of telepresence, Mac to Mac, has been here for 5 years.
Yeah, it's nothing
now,
new.
The fact that Cisco brings it in a room where you can dedicate a third of a T1 or half a T1 to it, that's great. It's a whole different thing. It's better user experience, and it's, you know, bigger, badder. You can do a whole conference room. I get that.
Yeah.
But that kind of telepresence has been here. That's not new.
Yeah, and, you know, they've been using it, like Kinko's have conference areas that, you know,
that's right,
have a big, you know, TV on the wall. You have to pay out serious bucks to get it, but, in the, you know, under the right circumstances, it's the thing to do.
I've seen the Cisco commercials, but until I saw that on the list, I assumed that it is what it is, and then I saw it on the list, I'm like, oh, maybe it's more than what I think it is. Maybe it's, but it's not. I thought, you know, maybe they have, like, little holographic images running around. You know, maybe Obi-Wan can send a message in 3D. No, you can't.
No, not yet. Universal Translator is the 10th item. Well, actually, I guess that's the 11th item if you count the photon torpedo coffin. But the for me and you, the 10th item is the Universal Translator, and that is a cool thing depending on how well it works.
I saw a – this is 08 now. So in 04. The winner of 0304 4 years ago now, I saw a demo of a handheld device, probably bigger than two Blackberries, maybe about the size of a VHS tape.
Okay.
Thing didn't have as many phrases as this thing is describing, and it didn't support as many languages. But it was basically only supporting languages that you find in remote areas of Afghanistan, and it worked. And the thing that was cool about it, although this article doesn't talk about this one that way, the thing that was totally cool is you could teach it stuff. So you're in the field using it, and if you could, by sign language or by having a third party translate for you, you could actually teach the device things that later, you, when you're, it's just you and somebody that doesn't speak English, it would still work, and it was all voice activated, and it was like a pretty rugged, solid little device. I was totally impressed. It sounds like it's a lot better. In cool factor, I put it way up there. I think it's just a matter of time. I'm with Kurzweil on this one. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's 5 years or 10 years or what it is, but some guy in his garage has this beat, and that's coming. So incremental improvements there, yes, very cool.
Well, you know, voice recognition is built. You know, the built-in technology that makes this possible is voice recognition, and I'm looking forward to that. Take some load off of my typing and things. But, you know, I mean, when they get it to where, you know, I'm sorry, but 90% accurate is not good enough. They're missing one word in 10, you know, when they've got 90% accuracy. I really need 99% accuracy before I even bother with those systems. You know?
Well, and you need the accuracy in a way that the miss is either trivial or obvious.
Yeah.
Right. If the miss is not trivial and maybe not obvious, now you can't use it because the risk is too big that it ends up producing something stupid.
Yeah.
Which I do all the time anyway.
We don't need any help.
Anything,
right?
But that's right.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. Well, that's the 10. I listed off the 10 there. Now, you had a problem with a couple of them, Michael.
The coffin we've already dogged to death.
Yeah.
The Vocera badge, the communicator, the little device that you wear and can talk to. Cool device, not new. I saw it 5 years ago. The telepresence, I've had that in my Mac laptop for the last 5 years. Now, I haven't used it much, and now you gotta jump through more hoops than you used to have to, but it's cool. It's just not new.
I should ask, why isn't it? Isn't it that we are not? Why is it that we're not using video when we communicate? I mean, I on a daily basis, I never use it. You know, I've got the capability. I've got a computer here with a webcam on it. You know, but you know, when I go to call somebody, I don't feel a necessity.
That's a good question.
You know,
I mean,
if I knew that they had it,
we don't really need it.
Yeah.
Right. That's one thing. We can have this conversation. We don't really need video.
Right.
But that's just because we're organized this way. If we had video from the get-go, we probably would be, like, shocked that people lived without it.
Right. I guess so. I guess part of it is that, you know, you can call somebody at home and you don't feel bad about, you know, you don't feel so bad about disturbing.
And we're not organized for it either because I'm not dressed to be, you know, video right now.
Yeah. And
And I'm not lit right, and it wouldn't look good. And, you know, there's other reasons. But there was one we left off. We left off the phaser gun.
Ah, yeah.
This is the handheld device where if you read the article, not the list, but the article that Network World originally wrote about it, they describe it as handheld lightning. And comes in lethal and non-lethal varieties. I thought, okay, now this is very cool. This is the thing I was saying, yeah, but this is based on the original Tesla ray gun, where it was a high-energy handheld or hand-holdable device. Very cool. And the thing that kills me about Network World, now here they include the theme coffin and they include a couple things that really aren't new. In the article, the original article about this handheld lightning, which is a much better name than phaser gun, even though phaser gun does make it Star Trek-y, the article references something the Navy rolled out in January last year that they were calling the pixelated rail gun. And this is a gun, a projectile device, but the range is 200 to 250 miles.
Whoa. Well,
I mean, but I'm like, that is cool. Well, how do you use it? You use it, it's a poor man's Tomahawk missile, for one.
I guess so.
I mean, to project force from the fleet, wherever the boat happens to be, 200 to 250 miles away by shooting a gun? I mean, even in the article they point out about that thing, they point out that when it's finally done and deployed, and maybe it was kind of quiet about when that would be, but when they rolled it out a year ago, it's like they have it. This is not, we're going to do this, maybe one day we'll have it. It's like, oh no, we have it. When they fully deploy it, they're estimating $1,000 a shot when you to fire it.
Which
and like
is,
versus atomic missiles, like $1 million a copy.
Wow. Yeah. That and so you could deploy that force much more economically, I guess. So yeah.
There's that, and you can do things that are a lot less. I mean, I don't want to get into the political debate about when's appropriate to use lethal and non-lethal and when's a show of force and when's – but a gun of that kind of range, a projectile device, that's huge. I mean, well, 250 miles, I don't think you could put something in orbit with that, but it's a big deal. And it didn't make the list because Star Trek didn't shoot a lot of projectiles.
Well, that is cool, though. I like that. Well, anyway, I guess we've gone through that list pretty thoroughly, haven't we?
Yes. My frustration has been vented adequately.
Okay. Well, great. You wanted to talk about another subject we mentioned just before the show got started, and it involves the growing of organs.
Phil put up a story about the what I was calling the chia heart. You take the protein structure that was the heart, get everything else off of it, and then add cells, and voila, you grow a heart.
How do you get the protein structure of the heart, though? That sounds
correct.
You know, in order to make $1 million, first you start with $1 million, or you know. Yeah. Well, how do you get the protein structure of the heart? I guess that's the big trick. What did that do? Did you read that? Get into it.
Yeah, I read it. It's over my head. It's one of those things where if you go to the source material, you're like, we got to go get the guy who understands the source material, and he's, you know, unfortunately not available.
Yeah.
But the research goal is to say, okay, if we can show that you can get these cells to basically turn on and grow the organ, then you kind of multi-track, which is the next phase now, where you say we're going to start growing other organs, we're going to grow them for other mammals, and you say, how do we synthesize that protein structure? How do we sort of artificially, or it wouldn't really be artificial so much as it would be, how do we replicate that structure without having to, you know, to make $1 million, first start with $2 million, and then, you know, you get $1 million.
And then withdraw.
And that's where the research is going.
Right. Well, and so you start, you have that structure, you add in progenitor cells that grow within the structure and become whatever organ you want it to be.
That's right.
And so, you know,
if you could do it in a way that you take the progenitor cells out of the person who ultimately needs the organ, then in that transplant universe, you can mitigate, hopefully, the complications that arise from your own immune system rejecting the transplant.
Right.
Because that no longer is a factor. It really is you.
Okay. Yeah. And that's one of the biggest problems with being a transplant patient. You are a patient for the rest of your life because you're taking these drugs that have, I understand, pretty rough side effects.
It's all your life to keep
rejecting the organ that you've been given.
That's right. It's not something you choose, but for the alternative is you have no heart.
Right, and die.
You suck it up because you do it. But I jokingly call it the chia heart because there's no way to react. To me, there's no rational, useful way to react to that kind of research. It's too huge.
Yeah.
Like, what do you say to that guy who grows a heart?
Well done, you.
Yeah,
as the UK, as our UK listeners would say. Yeah, it's that's pretty awesome. That's a huge step. And of course, there's some things like a pancreas and things like that have never been successfully transplanted. And so I just wonder if you could take something like this and like grow it within the patient who needed it. And the science and medicine of transplant would be changing if you could grow one.
You'd say, oh, I'm in my 40s, I'm healthy, I'm good, my heart's in good shape. I'm going to grow one now.
Mm.
And then when I need it,
before
it's available.
Yeah, and it's beating away in a vat someplace and until such time as you need it. Pretty cool.
Yeah.
That is awesome. And, you know, no matter how well we take care of ourselves, our hearts age. And so wouldn't it be cool if at age, you know, 80 or whenever, you know, when you get old, you could have a transplant as a 20-year-old heart into your body. So that'd be pretty cool, too, wouldn't it?
Yes.
And it's your own heart,
would be
too.
Good.
I'm sorry?
Eyes also. I'm dealing with adjusting to having glasses for the first time in my life, and I want my youthful eyes and, well, frankly, I want my youthful knees back as well.
Well, of the two, you'd probably go with knees, wouldn't you? The
yes, I would. Yes, I would.
Yeah, I figured as much. The eyes can be fixed pretty easily too. Are you a candidate for the laser?
No, basically I'm complaining about reading glasses. It's like the lowest form of eye correction intervention available to mankind. It's no big deal, and that's why if you could give me the choice between my youthful knees or my youthful eyes, I would take my knees in a heartbeat.
Well,
youthful heartbeat.
I've been wearing glasses since I was in the sixth, seventh grade, something like that, and I don't even think about it anymore because I wear them all the time. It's one of those things, you know, I reach for them as I get up in the morning because I literally cannot see without them. Now, I mean, I have good vision with them, but, you know, talk about an invention. This is not a new invention. It's been around, since 1600s or something like that, eyeglasses in one form or another.
Yeah.
But you talk about changing people's lives. That was a huge step, wasn't it? But,
it was big. I'm guessing that until, you know, most for literate people it was huge.
Yeah.
For the illiterate who could still see distance and see other stuff, not that big a deal.
Yeah.
Not a lot of precision work going on in the 15th century.
Well, I can tell you, if I had to have my eyes without my glasses, it would be a big deal.
Wow.
Literally, I would not. I would.
See, and here's where I go being stupid without any kind of voice activation. It's just, I lack that perspective, never having had to cope with it.
Yeah. I hope you never do. It's not a big deal when you have the glasses. I'm just glad to have the glasses. Anyway, I guess we'll move on to another subject. We have been covering, a lot recently, energy topics. And this week, I blogged about the race to plug in our hybrids. What we've had so far, to me, as far as on the road, these hybrids that we have now, it's a good first step. But I don't know that it's been really worth it economically to the buyer of these cars, or environmentally. I don't know, particularly when you're using nickel cadmium batteries. Not a very environmentally, good way of, these batteries, when they go and get the nickel out of the ground, I mean, it leaves a moonscape behind, okay? And, anyway, so that's not really...
This is actually up on the blog. There was a discussion about the toxicity of the nickel mines, but I will say that one of the unintended beneficial consequences of a nickel mine in Canada is that there's a mine shaft that goes a little over 400 feet down, something like 30 plus meters. And in this cavern down there, they were able to put a large pool of water. It is a neutrino detector. So you say, well, yeah, but on the Earth, on the surface, up on top, it is a moonscape, and it's a nickel mine, and it's toxic. But down there, they put it in this big tub, and they use it as a neutrino detector. And but for the shielding of all that Earth and the actual construct of the mine, you wouldn't be able to get this thing funded.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's toxic, yeah. But we get a neutrino detector.
Oh, yeah. Always looking on the bright side here at Fast Forward Radio. But, yeah, to me, though, when hybrids get real and when I'll be actually interested in purchasing one is when we move to lithium-ion batteries that can plug in. And why? Because the electricity we get out of the wall when we plug in is, you know, the equivalent amount of energy, say, for that we get out of a gallon of gasoline costs 75 cents. So imagine a 75-cent gallon of gasoline nowadays when we're paying like...
We grew up with that, but that's you're right. It's,
yeah.
You think about it today... and
what are you paying where you're at for your gas right now?
$279, $285 is sort of the norm.
Yeah, I filled up my wife's vehicle yesterday. It was $289.
And that's you know the lowest octane available around here.
Ooh, yeah, it's just and you know I think it'll get higher as you know I hate to be doom and gloom, but I really do believe gas prices are going to go up. Rather than down,
the logic would suggest that that's true, and perhaps even you know if we want to as a national unit mimic some of the other national economies where they've reversed the positive correlation between oil consumption and economic growth, meaning they can grow their economy and consume less oil.
Yeah,
the two that leap to mind are England and Japan. Now they're in a unique situation in a sense anyway because they're island nations and you know they had to go offshore to find the oil in the first place, so to force their economies to get into a situation where they could grow and expand their economy with less energy, so they have an inverse relationship to energy consumption or oil consumption particularly. If we wanted to mimic that, then of course the prices would have to go up, and you know we all know that in Europe and in other parts of the world, many economies pay way more for gasoline than we do, and in part that's a policy decision that says, hey, we want to motivate a way to organize the economy that we're not as dependent on it. I'm not so sure we have the national will to do that. I'm not even sure that's the right answer, but either way, the logic does suggest, yeah, gasoline is going higher here.
And when it does, then these sort of solutions get a lot more attractive, don't they?
Yeah, they do, and the thing that kills me, it's about the technology of hybrids. I know I saw your piece, and Lutz saying, "Hey, we just want to get this first, and we want to be right." And I hope he's sincere, and I hope he's got enough of the company behind him. Lutz, by the way, you know, here's a guy who, if that guy's not 180 years old, he's 80 years old. I mean, he's pretty senior leadership over there, and
right,
I'm hoping
right.
that he's around to see this thing into the field if he's sincere. A lot of people. In the hybrid world, in the electric car world, aren't really as convinced that Lutz and GM in general is as sincere. I sent it to Phil. I don't think it's up on the Speculist, but I saw a YouTube-sized little video from the Detroit Auto Show that just ended last week. It was the guy who actually goes to great pains to give his exact title in this little video, and I think he's the VP of Ops for the Volt or whatever. He's like the lead guy on the floor or in Warren, Michigan, to build the Volt.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, he's the devil, because he says like three times in this presentation, yeah, the battery technology just doesn't exist and there's no sense building it today. So we're hoping by 2010 we can do X, Y, and Z. And I'm like, yeah, I don't agree with that. And I don't agree with it without having the technology in my living room. I can't prove it. But same week, different story, guy in Seattle used a Saturn View, which comes in a hybrid version.
Mm-hmm.
He modified it using his own plug-in platform and says, okay, here's a plug-in hybrid. You can go 80 miles, not 8, that's 80 miles in all-electric mode. Well, for most of American commuters, and certainly in most of my daily driving, I'd be all-electric.
Oh, yeah, all the time. With 80.
You drag around an internal combustion engine, And it's not clear in his description of it, partly because he was trying to pitch GM to just license his idea, but his patents do include some pretty high-capacity batteries, some flywheel technology, and some ultra-capacitor technology. And I'm thinking, yeah, you put all three of those together, you have a hybrid, right? Because you have different ways of plugging into the electric to the grid and storing electricity and then going out to drive in the morning. But I was like, yeah, there's other people doing other interesting things. And the guy who says, yeah, it's not there. Well, maybe it's not there at the price point you're aiming at. And that's the part where I'm not automotive expert enough to really do the math and go, yeah, if you got to bring a Volt to the market for $150,000 a copy, forget it.
That's not going to work.
If you got to hit a price point, then
they were actually aiming for a $30,000 Volt, and it looks like they're going to hit $40,000, which is too bad because I think that difference between $30,000 and $40,000 cuts a lot of the market out. But anyway, I'm just glad to see it come to the market at whatever price initially, and of course, future iterations will be cheaper. But anyway, the guy that you're talking about, the senior leadership at GM, that's GM Vice Chairman Bob Lutz, and he is championing the Volt, and he's calling it or agreed to with the reporter who asked him, "Is this your moonshot?" Yes, it is. This is we've got a lot riding on this, and so I believe that they're completely serious about this project, and so I wish them well because
I think we'll know. We won't have to wait to 2010 to know, either at the Detroit Auto Show a year from now, or sometime in the first quarter next year in 2009. If we're not hearing about delays, now we think we can get it out in 2012 or 2013. If we're not hearing that kind of thing, then sincerity is there, and they're gonna field the thing.
Well, and the
what
Saturn
the final numbers look like, price, performance, who knows? But if a year from now we're hearing about delays and we can't do this, we can't do that, then my confidence will be shattered.
Well, they're talking about the Saturn V plug-in being delivered in late 2009, and that's just right around the corner. So.
Yeah.
Apparently, they're quite serious about the technology. I love what Bob Lutz had to say. I love his quote. You know, he said, "There's nothing magic about this technology. 2 or 3 years after the Volt is introduced, everybody will have something like it. We'd just like to be first for once." So
that's right.
He believes it's obviously he considers it a race. And
those thinking hybrid, I will tell you one of the things I love about the design of the Volt. Is that it is serial and not parallel. By that I mean in this case the electric and whatever the combustible storage fuel will be. It'll probably be gasoline at first, although frankly if it was biodiesel or some sort of diesel hybrid, that wouldn't bother me either. I'd love that.
Yeah, me too.
But
I'm a big believer
in serial, right? So the diesel is there to charge the electric and the electric always runs the car, as opposed to a Prius and most other hybrids that you can find today. They run in parallel, and one side, either the electric or the gas or whatever, is used to supplement the other side under certain conditions. The serial gets really interesting when you think about the second and third generation, because now, rather than do it by mixing the two powers, it's just the electric gets better and better and better, and whatever comes before it. If hydrogen works, doesn't seem like to me all that plausible, but if it worked, great. Then you put that before the electric, and you just use the electric to drive the car. Nothing else in the car changes. The drive chain doesn't change. The differential doesn't change. The brakes and tires don't change. All that changes is you take out the internal combustion engine and replace it with something else to drive the electric.
Well, you know what?
I like the fact that it's serial. I like that.
Yeah, and so you have that torque from electric that just will put you back in your seat every time you hit the – well, not the gas.
If you haven't seen it, I think Phil put it up once, but the Tango, and Tango's got some video on YouTube, but they basically built an enclosed motorcycle.
Yeah.
It is a four-wheel vehicle, and because of the way they built it, and they basically get a NASCAR cage, so they can call it a car and make it very safe, but the torque test for this thing, it's off the chart.
Yeah,
it's comical how much torque you can get because of the dynamics of an electric engine.
Well, the thing I really like about the car, you know, and I'm hearing you on the serial thing. That's cool that it's all electric all the time, and so you're not having the transition kick back and forth. I don't know how smooth that is. because, frankly, I've never driven in a Prius. And that gets me to my point, because the Prius looks like a piece of crap, okay? It doesn't look like anything I'd be caught dead in, whereas the Volt, man, that's a sexy car. I would love to have that car.
I've seen different pictures of what a Volt would look like, but yes,
the current prototype or whatever is
concept. Yeah, it does look awesome.
Yeah, and I hope that they stick close to that, because it looks cool, and I'd love to have that. That's
my personal preference is for convertibles, and you know it's in the car market, convertibles tend to be a smaller market anyway, so nobody does their first version of a car in a convertible. You're not going to see the Volt come out in a removable hardtop in its first go.
Right.
But my personal preference would be something like a 53 Coupe de Ville, you know, big, boaty, curvy, with no top. But that's just me.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean that would be cool, and a hardtop convertible. I mean, where you just hit the button and the top goes away. You know, I mean, how cool would that be? That'd be fun.
Or you could make the top out of that transparent armor, and now, you know, you could look through it if you want. If you want to take it off, you take it off.
Or you hit a button and it becomes opaque. You can't see through it. You can see through it when you want to.
That's right.
That's cool. Cool stuff.
Now the race to plug-ins. I think when people get over the idea of, if I have to plug my car in, then I can only drive as far as my longest extension cord. When they get past that and realize that, oh, yeah, I can plug it in overnight, but you know what? If I don't plug it in overnight, big deal. I
gasoline.
Turn the key in the morning and I drive away.
Right. And I can always buy gasoline like I've always done, but I have the option of plugging in and getting the equivalent of a 75-cent gallon of gas, which that's a selling point for a lot of people. And people will pay more for the car if they know that they can get that, because they can do the math. They can see, yeah, it pays for itself. You know, the additional price at the point of purchase pays for itself. You know, if gas is $3, you know, it pays for itself pretty quick. So, yeah. Anyway, I mean, and the whole thing about going plug-in, obviously, is to get us a little more energy independent. And there's a lot of good things that happen from that. And one of the things is that we're no longer dependent on these troubled spots in the world for most of our energy. And that was a big point that Zubrin had made. I think we've got Phil on the line, and let's see if we can bring him in.
He's traveling in time. He was obviously in our future. He came back to tell us something from the future.
Phil, is that you?
Yes, it is. Hello,
hey,
guys.
How are you doing, Phil?
I'm good. Let me explain how that works. You see, there was a possible future in which I called in. Actually, there were nearly an infinite number of possible variations on when I might have called in. And now we have realized one of those possible futures. And in fact,
Phil, we were usually we aim for an hour long show, but now that you're here, we can roll another 30 minutes if you want to.
Well, I appreciate that, guys. Actually, I have stepped out from a meeting that was called impromptu as soon as I arrived, and I'm just able to be on here for just a couple of minutes real quick. But I said I have to go make an urgent phone call because I wanted to join and see how the show was going.
Okay, so give us the nutshell version. Cloverfield, gotta go see it on the big screen. Wait for it on DVD. Are you joking? Don't go see it.
Yeah, which camp do you fall into, Phil, on Cloverfield?
Do you guys not read The Speculist? Hello. Thank you.
For the benefit of our
I plan to read it in the future.
I think you should check that up in the future. I recommend it highly, absolutely recommend it. I think it's great fun. I think it's very clever. Just a really good time. Not a good family film. Good grown-up fun. And, some folks...
Did you have to take your Dramamine?
Like,
did you take Dramamine before you went in?
You know, I didn't notice that effect nearly as strongly with Cloverfield as I did with Blair Witch. I think they might have thought about that a little bit. There definitely are moments when you're just going, geez, if they just hold the camera still. But there's also quite a bit of time when you're just completely caught up in the story and you're not even thinking about that. And one of the things I wrote in my review is that as you're watching this film, you're sitting on the edge of the seat. It occurred to me the reason I'm sitting on the edge of my seat, and one of the reasons I think that it's so effective, is you're actually trying to get a better view sometimes of what's happening. You know, that frustration you get sometimes when you're watching what somebody has videotaped and it's not quite the right angle that you want. And they did it on purpose. I think it's really clever.
That's high praise. And one of the comments that somebody put up, and I, by the way, did read your entry. I was just trying to get you onto the subject. Somebody put up that they went to see it with somebody who is highly susceptible to frightening films and came away highly frightened. How do you feel about that?
Which is praise, I think, yes. It's a scary movie, so if that's what if you're okay with a scary movie, then you're going to get what was advertised.
Yeah, it's scary. It plays on real fears, which I think some of the criticism that's been leveled at the movie is that, you know, it's this monster movie and it's exploitive because it's playing on our memories of 9/11. But the truth is that's what that genre has always done.
Right.
If you look back to Godzilla, you know, the original Japanese movie Gojira is about dealing with the fear of nuclear war and the fallout from a nuclear war. And
I
think that,
all that.
Exactly. You know, it makes perfect sense that movie would have come from Japan, where they had actually been victims of that. These monster movies are a Freudian way of playing out our darkest fantasies, our darkest fear, in a kind of a sort of semi-safe way. And I think there's something. I would just say that a movie like that has a good pedigree going back to.
Well, and it also has more relevance if you blow up New York. Yeah, I get that 911 was there. Maybe there's some sensitivity to that, but it's different if you blow up Tulsa or Colorado Springs or Dallas. It's just different.
Absolutely, it is. Well, and I think that was something that maybe Spielberg was thinking of. I think he was conscious of this. You don't want to get too close to 9/11 when he made the remake of War of the Worlds, and he had all the stuff coming down in Jersey City rather than across the river in Manhattan. He didn't want to draw those comparisons. And, of course, he was being true to the Orson Welles War of the Worlds by having it occur in New Jersey rather than in New York. But that was one of the things where, I don't know, that movie might have been a little stronger had it, just from an iconic standpoint, had it occurred in New York rather than New Jersey.
Well, Phil, I appreciate you taking a minute and visiting with us. Do you need to run now, or?
Well, I probably should, but it's great talking with you guys, and I'll let you wrap up the show. Have a good evening.
Thank you very much, Phil.
We'll see you guys. Bye.
Okay. Bye. Appreciate him taking a moment like that. Slipping out of a meeting. This is a man who's got his priorities right.
He's hanging around with other guys, having a beer, talking about something else.
Well, they can give him a few minutes to make a call like that. I mean, they have him traveling all over the country on a fairly regular basis. Give the man a break. So,
That's right.
I do appreciate him calling in on all that. Well, I mean, I guess it's time then to wrap up the show. Did you have anything that you wanted to throw in here at the end, Michael?
No, nothing that can't wait till next time or show up in print.
That's right. Okay, well, we do have some music tonight. We actually have some choices. I think I'm going to go with World War Z. And World War Z, should I say what it's about? Nah, I'll let everybody hear it. World War Z is by the band CSHC, and I guess I'm just going to play it and let everybody hear it. I had a great time tonight.
Me too.
And looking forward to returning again next week. I believe we have a roundtable discussion, and there'll be more on that. We'll put that up here shortly and let y'all know what it's about. But anyway, it'll be same time, 9 o'clock, Central Time, wherever it is that you're hearing us next Sunday night. So look forward to seeing y'all again or hearing from y'all again. All right, here's World War Z. Good night.
As though they were in a kind of trance, were killing and eating their victims, prompted authorities to examine the bodies of some of the victims. Medical authorities in Cumberland have concluded that in all cases, the killers are eating. Repeating this latest bulletin just received moments ago from Cumberland, Maryland, civil defense authorities have told newsmen that murdered victims show evidence of having been partially devoured by their murderers. Medical examination of victims' bodies shows conclusively that the killers are eating the flesh of the people they killed. And so this incredible story...
joke. You know I always keep it real. Give yourself a gut check. Got the nerves of steel. It's gonna get epic, just like that tournament unreal. If you've been dipped in the sticks, better hide your heel. Remember that it's justice we dispense. Just stick to the killing, there won't be a consequence. Take a look around, absorb the evidence. They're already dead. The plan ain't violence.
There's supposed to be another broadcast at 3:00.
10 minutes.
Oh, only 10 more minutes?
If your buddy gets bit, you better take him out. They'll come after you, this is true, don't doubt. This ain't my first time, fight me or dead. And if I see one bite, I'll put a bullet in your head. I know that ain't cool, but it's just self-preservation. What if you become a ghoul? I'm in it to win it, so don't you take me for a fool. It's kill if you kill, yeah, that's the rule. But now the time for talk is done. It's gonna take all we got to get this war won. Killing's already begun. I look to the front and we're being overrun. Time slows down, everything goes dim. My buddy's got a couple trying to tear him limb from limb. I set him on the fire, now the situation's not so slim. But then I see him bleeding, damn, they got him.
Latest word also from National Press Services in Washington, D.C. now tells us that the emergency presidential conference, which we've just mentioned, will include high-ranking scientists.
If I were surrounded by 6 or 8 of these things, would I stand a chance with them?
Well, there's no problem. If you had a gun, shoot him in the head. That's a sure way to kill him.
My buddy goes down, a bullet in his face. At least I got to him before he joined the cursed race. I asked for someone else to come and take his place and tell me how much longer will we fight at this pace. I see my share of war, but this is something else. I'm running and I'm running in circles like carousels. I fire instinctively and my nerves are raw. And everywhere I turn, I see a zombie with a bloody jaw. This is a losing battle. They're gonna eat my brain. I can't believe I'm giving up. I must be insane. I wanna survive, but I can't maintain. Maybe suicide's a thought I should start to entertain. If this is a dream, tell me why can't I wake up? My friends all died before the military showed up. I keep pushing on, but I just want to give up. I'm at the end of my rope, and I just don't give up. Helicopters coming, tanks in the street, soldiers everywhere, and they're all packing heat. Bullets and mortars, we want to be defeat, but the zombies keep coming on. Rolling to eat. Round 5, man down. There's nowhere left to hide, nothing left in this town. So much blood, you would think you'd drown. In all this, from sunrise till sundown. Now I think I'm finally gonna crack, cause the zombies keep pushing, so I gotta push back. I look for a weapon so I can join the attack. I find a crowbar, then my vision goes black. As I'm falling, I can hear him talking. I'm gonna die, so the zombies come flocking. I'm being eaten by these undead lunatics. I grab another character sheet and roll 3 more d6.